And we move for the fifth case today, United States v. Sloan.
May it please this honorable court, Carl Clavelli arguing on behalf of Mr. Keith Sloan, Your Honor. This is an individual who was charged with a very serious offense in three of about 15 counts of mail fraud. He entered pleas of not guilty, and before the case came to trial, a plea agreement was prepared between the parties, in which which was based on a superseding information, a misdemeanor. The issue of restitution was addressed in the written plea agreement, but the restitution, even though the government argued that restitution was mandatory, on page 13 of that plea agreement, the very next sentence was that Sloan reserves the right to object to this. Now, when we look at a case which is subsequent...
Did he object?
I'm sorry.
Did he object?
You mean at the at the actual sentencing hearing? No.
Did he waive it?
I don't believe so.
Right.
I don't believe it's waived because I don't believe it was shown that based on this really bare-bones record, which is attached, I believe, in Appendix C, that it was clear that the parties knew what was being asked of them.
Well, didn't Sloan's lawyer later agree that the amount of restitution was the $638,000 figure?
Judge, you kind of hit the $64,000 question, and I cannot say on this record, based on this court's own observations in cases like Havens, where you kind of say to the district court judges, put some explanation in the record as to how and why you are arriving at this. So when Sloan's lawyer, who put into the written plea agreement the objection to the restitution, and said in the PSR, we're not responsible, we didn't know there was a fraud going on, when he says, I'm in agreement, I believe he is saying, I agree that the other paralegal did not get a conviction because she was not in the office. I don't know if the lawyer's attention was distracted for about 3 seconds, which is about all it would have taken, if you were to look at the series. It just is not clear from this record.
Well,
that
go ahead. So, but if we look at it as if, I mean, if we look at it for what it appears to be, that he's agreeing, then you've got a problem, because this could have been raised on direct appeal, and now you're outside the scope of the writ, and so you got a problem.
I don't believe so, but I understand Your Honor's point of view here. It seems to me, based on Randall, this was not something that the parties could have waived. Now, I've had some second thoughts myself when I look at the Randall opinion and I look at Judge Posner's dissent, where he says, well, it looks like there may have been a mutual mistake here as to whether or not restitution was valid. But I indicated in a footnote that that's not the case here, because the written plea agreement, he opposes restitution. Mm-hmm. And I cannot explain why he would oppose it in the written. I mean, why not just say, if there's any restitution, it's got to be the $174,000 for the one property? Why not even throw that up to the court?
Mm-hmm.
I think the court said restitution is mandatory and required, and there is that word required coming from the judge, which was the position of the government, and that the lawyer said, well, you know, he feels it's required, I'm not going to object.
Or he could have said, I understand how the court arrives at that figure, but we're not responsible for that. No, I mean, you know, because the agreement could be this, it would be the amount under the calculation made by the probation officer and by this court. But we don't agree with that amount. We're only responsible for 174.
I cannot defend the silence that was made there, but I can say to the court that an injustice was done. And it's really...
Didn't the court ask him, is the restitution amount correct? And didn't he...
Judge...
And now wait, let me finish, and then you
yes.
talk. And didn't he answer, yes, the attorney, I agree with that, yes.
I don't believe the lawyer is referring to the restitution amount.
Oh, I see now.
I don't believe...
Even though the court asked him if he was...
I believe...
If the restitution was correct, and he answered, yes, he wasn't focusing on that.
I believe the focus was on the question about the paralegal, because you can certainly say, yes... if Your Honor holds him to the 14 properties, that's the right amount, but we don't agree that he should get that restitution. Yeah. The case, I believe, should be decided on the fact that the court did not have subject matter jurisdiction under this one-count information. When we follow the Randall opinion, we cannot take the plea agreement, as the government is trying to do, and say there is agreement. The written plea agreement, there is no agreement. And if there is, and even if there was agreement, you cannot confer subject matter jurisdiction by agreement of the parties. And I believe that law is settled.
Well, we have a situation, though, where the counsel not only agreed that the amount was correct, but there was no Rule 35 motion on this after it was imposed.
There was
right?
not. There was not, Judge. Now, if Your Honor is referring to the Supreme Court case cited by the government on Carlisle, which relies on Rule 29, I don't believe it's the same situation. Yes, quorum nobis may not apply when there is a specific rule on point. I don't think Rule 35 would qualify in this regard. I do think the court is correct that there could have been an effort to file a notice of appeal, and that was not done. But then the same 7 days applies. I think it's more accurate to say they didn't realize exactly what had happened, particularly within the 7 day period. And I'm not sure if anybody realized it until the government moved for an order of garnishment. But that's okay, because when the government moved for an order of garnishment, as the Ninth Circuit has found, that gave this court jurisdiction. We appealed from that order. And this court now can look at whether or not the district court had subject matter jurisdiction. And why should somebody be saddled with $600,000+ that they really aren't responsible for when the court has the ability to correct an injustice? And I feel either quorum nobis is appropriate or simply the fact that we have a direct appeal from the order of garnishment. And that is what we have here, Your Honors. So I do believe that the court has a jurisdiction. I don't believe that the record below somehow creates a waiver. I don't think you can waive something like this. And the written plea agreement would indicate that there was no meeting of the minds on this issue, and that was what a waiver requires. So, Your Honors, I believe that this portion of the criminal judgment is illegal, not the balance of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. Ms. Childs?
May it please the court, counsel, a deal is a deal, and Sloan made a deal in this case. He voluntarily signed a plea agreement in which he knowingly waived his right to appeal and waived his right to collaterally attack any aspect of his sentence, including the restitution. The restitution amount was stated in the plea agreement, and now Sloan wants to vacate that contract but not go back to square one. He's not asking you to throw out the plea agreement in its entirety. He just wants you to get rid of the part that he does not like.
Now, the amount of loss for the offense forming the basis for the conviction was this $173,000. I understand you know how you got to your other calculation, but that was at least a hard number.
Yes. The offense that he pled guilty to and was convicted of is in violation of 1012, which is a fraud statute. It is an offense against property. And so restitution is mandatory for that offense against property involving the count that he pled to for that particular property, which is, I believe that loss was $173,000. But the agreement, in the plea agreement, he does acknowledge these 14 other transactions that resulted in the greater loss amount. Now, in hindsight, this plea agreement was drafted before Randall was decided. We can look back on it since Randall and say, well, the way that it's written now, $173,000 is the figure, whereas $641,000. But that's what the bargain was at the time.
Well, do you agree that if the amount of restitution ordered exceeded the district court's statutory authority, that Sloan should have some recourse?
I think he did have recourse, and he waived that at every turn. He waived it in the plea agreement itself. He chose to waive his right to appeal or collaterally attack the sentence.
What do you think collaterally attack the sentence includes?
For example, the coram nobis action that he's bringing now. I mean, this is an appeal of the garnishment order that was entered.
Is this a collateral attack?
I think he is using the appeal of the garnishment order to attack the underlying restitution order.
Isn't he just responding to your garnishment order?
We're enforcing the restitution order, and his response is to say, you can't enforce the restitution order because the underlying order was illegal.
So that's a collateral attack within the meaning of the plea agreement?
I believe so. He's waived this at every turn. Again, in the plea agreement, the figure was restated in the pre-sentence report. He did not file any objection to the pre-sentence report. The matter was raised as expected at the sentencing hearing. There was no objection at that time. Sloan was at the sentencing hearing when this happened. The court asked his attorney if the restitution amount was correct, and he said, I agree with that, yes.
Let me ask you this. If Sloan's attorney had agreed at sentencing that the restitution amount was $5 million, would you take the position that there was nothing that could be done to correct the amount?
I think, again, there are opportunities to correct a substantive error in the sentence, but and mistakes happen. There's a time to correct them, and this is not that time. He did not challenge it within 7 days under Rule 35. He didn't seek any correction of the restitution amount in the sentence. He didn't file an appeal to attack his waiver or say that the restitution was inappropriate at that time. If he's arguing ineffective assistance of counsel, that Sloan stood mute while his attorney acquiesced to that figure, I think is stated in his brief, well, even if the argument is ineffective assistance of counsel, the time for him to raise that has long since passed. If he had brought it up, something different might have happened. We might have changed the language in the plea agreement to make it more explicit to include that amount. We might have reduced the amount. I can't say that today, what we might have done now for, I think it's more than 4 years ago.
Now, the plea agreement stated that the amount of restitution would be reduced by the amounts, by the sale of this foreclosed property. How much were the property sold for, and was there any credit given to him for that?
That information is not in the record. I don't know and can't say at this time. If you'd like me to supplement that, I may be able to.
Well, what about the other 10 who were jointly and severally liable co-defendants? Are there garnishment orders against them?
The restitution judgment against Mr. Sloan and each of the co-defendants who are jointly and severally liable is enforceable for 20 years. We make every effort to collect restitution from each of those defendants.
Garnishment orders, you don't know whether they've been filed with respect to the other co-defendants?
For each of the other co-defendants, that information is not in the record. I can't say at this time. So I believe he's waived this at every turn. To give Sloan a do-over now would really disrupt the entire established statutory scheme and rules that govern appeals of illegal sentences. There's a substantial interest in the finality of judgments, and I think in the Keene case there's a discussion that everyone's entitled to a full and fair opportunity to litigate their case once, but no one's entitled to multiple opportunities to do so. And when does that stop? If he's not satisfied with the restitution order the first time around, if we go back and revisit that long after his time to appeal it or attack it has expired, who's to say he's going to be pleased with what happens the second time around? And then can he come back and attack that? I mean, when does the inquiry end? Again, I think mistakes happen. There's a time to fix them or correct them. He cannot, through this appeal of the garnishment order, attack the underlying restitution order. It's just too late. And the Helmus Food Products case says that coram nobis is not available to do so, even if he neglected to address it for years. Years later, he can't invoke this extraordinary remedy of coram nobis to uncrack the egg, is the terminology used in that case. So before I finish, I'd like to inform the court that there is another appeal pending in United States v. David Mandel, number 053473, that does have a similar restitution issue.
Is that set for argument?
It has not been set for argument. It's fully briefed, and the appellant waived oral argument in that case, so it's just pending a decision, but I wanted you to be aware that there's a similar issue.
And that number
in that
again?
Case. It's USA v. David Mandel, M-A-N-D-E-L, 053473. So unless the court has any further questions, I ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Mr. Capelli.
May I say to the court that I am familiar with the Mandel appeal. I took a look at the briefs. It is not a case that we control this because the district court judge in that case had jurisdiction and could have entered that amount, and the issue is whether the amount was reasonable, whether, since it wasn't mandatory, whether the judge should have taken into consideration his ability to pay. Here, according to the plea agreement that the government prepared at page 13, it was mandatory, and the judge felt that way. When we look at such cases, even as a case like In re Craig Hansen, a bankruptcy case that this court decided on a very narrow basis because the judgment was void. That's the basis that the court, in my opinion, should be thinking, this is not a matter of finality or a matter of revisiting. As the court says in this case, if there is no harm to the parties, if there's no reason not to revisit it, finality by itself is not a good reason not to make sure that due process will not violate it. And I feel that there should be no difference in this case from a case like In re Craig Hansen, 397 F3rd 42. And if we look at United States versus Mays, where, and of course under this program where we have this restitution, it's always collected after the fact. And so the district courts are going to be entering orders all the time about garnishment and that type of thing. And as the Ninth Circuit said, well, subject matter jurisdiction is never waived and is always addressable by the court. And that's where I think the case lies. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.